det forklarer han på den måde, at han har interviewet enkelte. Han ville vist gerne have interviewet mange flere, der var på den anden side, fordi han mener, det er vigtigt at få disse beretninger. Det er jo en del af historien. Han har selvfølgelig været udsat for kritik. Han fortæller om en journalist, der troede, han kunne få nærmest en havde historie ud af det, fordi han gjorde stærke indvendinger. Han ringede og gjorde indvendinger mod, at Conrad Wood optog disse beretninger fra såkaldte fjender, og skrev vist også en artikel om det i avisen, som han sådan på en pæn måde siger, at det var en af de store og velrenommerede aviser. Og han siger her, at man skal faktisk være ret tykhudet for at gennemføre sådanne interviews. Men han har været specielt interesseret i netop at få historier fra fjenden. Og han har blandt andet interviewet japanere og italienere og tyskere også, og har været både i Rom og i Tyskland for at interviewe, men det kunne være lidt af et problem med sproget nogle gange. Og derfor har det ofte været nemmere og bedre at interviewe italienere, japanere eller tyskere, der havde slået sig ned i England efter krigen. Og han fortæller her om en mand, der var ombord på de tyske ubåde, som jo var nogle af de mest upopulære under krigen og mest hadet af englænderne, fordi de netop torpederede så mange engelske skibe, ikke kun krigsskibe, men handelsskibe og andre skibe med civile. Han fortæller et eksempel med en tysker, der havde slået sig ned i Skotland og havde giftet sig med en skotsk kvinde, og han havde været med til at sænke det engelske skib HMS Royal Oak ved Orkneyøerne. Han ønskede altså ikke at lade sig interviewe om sine erindringer, fordi han var simpelthen bange for at skulle blive hængt ud i lokalsamfundet, selvom man ikke sådan lige offentliggør arkiverne her, ja, så kunne man måske finde ud af, hvem han var, ved at finde hans navn i telefonbogen og så videre, og så overmale hans hus og den slags ting. Det brød han sig ikke om. Conrad Wood nævner en anden ungarer, som bor i England i dag, men som var på tysk side under 2. verdenskrig. Han kæmpede for Waffen-SS, eller i Waffen-SS, og talte meget rosende om Waffen-SS og deres kampe på Østfronten. Det var netop med denne optagelse, som den journalist, jeg nævnte før, opponerede så kraftigt imod.
Of course, you have to have a thick skin when you do things like this, but I mean, it's all part of history, a part of the whole picture, and if you want to show what the whole picture was like, you'd have to have that side of the story also, and as you're saying, the Japanese viewpoint would also be very interesting to describe.
Yes, those two Japanese men were actually living in London. Again, I couldn't afford the time and money to go to Japan, of course, to do interviews, but I found these two Japanese gentlemen, war veterans who'd fought British forces in the Far East, living in London, speaking reasonable English, and I remember them very well. I remember my own uncle had fought at Kohima, which was one of the great battles in Burma in 1944. He'd fought with the Royal Scots, a Scottish regiment in Kohima, and had been wounded in the throat. And one of the Japanese men that I interviewed had been Japanese Army supply sergeant at Kohima, in the same place. So I naturally told him, in between changing the reels, that my uncle had been wounded in the throat at Kohima, and he was very interested. And I noticed that he said to me, "How was he wounded in the throat?" And so I wondered whether he thought I was alleging some kind of atrocity, which I wasn't, because I think it was just a piece of shrapnel or a bullet wound in his throat. And there was certainly no, it was legitimate warfare, as it were, in which my uncle was wounded. Unfortunately, although I got the interview from the Japanese gentleman about Kohima, I've never been able to persuade my uncle to be tape recorded by me. But he's still alive, he's married to my father's sister.
Now, when you interview these Japanese ex-servicemen, do you find that they have any sense of guilt for their role in the Second World War?
I don't remember any feeling of guilt from those two particular gentlemen. And as far as I know, the accounts they gave me, they didn't have anything particularly to feel guilty about. They weren't men in charge of prisoner of war parties building the railway of death on the Burma-Siam railway or anything of that kind, in which case they might have been in an embarrassing position. They were, in the case of the man at Kohima, he was a supply sergeant with the Japanese army. He was told that he would accompany the Japanese forces advancing in Burma towards Kohima, towards India, and that each Japanese soldier would carry a supply of rice on his back, and that when they'd eaten that, they would have nothing, and that it was up to him as a supply sergeant to find food to feed a battalion, maybe 1,000 soldiers or something. He would have to find the food to keep them alive, because once they'd eaten their rice, there would be nothing. I think he told me that they managed to capture a British supply dump of rice, a go-down or a warehouse full of rice, in which they captured enough food to feed a Japanese division for about 3 years, I think he said. So he was quite lucky, but he was rather shocked, he told me, when he was told that he had this difficult task to perform. He was not a fighting soldier, he was on the lines of communication, but he had obviously an important job. And later on, the Japanese at Kohima did run out of food, and they were in a terrible, emaciated condition, many of them in diseased condition, as they gradually ran out of food. No, he didn't have any guilty conscience, and he did tell me, in fact, that he was rather ill-treated as a prisoner of war by our forces when he was captured at the end of the war, through insufficient food or something of that kind. I can't quite remember what he told me in the interview, but I do remember that he wasn't well treated as a prisoner himself. And I found it of particular interest to go to Germany and interview their veterans there. I must say that the German veterans I've interviewed in Germany have treated me very well. There have been no hard feelings towards me as an Englishman going to interview them. And they've treated me with every courtesy and hospitality when I visited them, and I've only found a desire for friendship amongst them. I very much hope, as we all do in Western Europe, that there isn't going to be any other war between the nations of Europe, England, Germany, France, Denmark, the rest of them, that we are going to continue to live at peace, and I do feel optimistic from that point of view. I do feel that the more freedom there is in a country, in a society, the less chance there is of war between them. I'm optimistic about the future. I think this is a development quite apart from the question of the European community. I think this is a long-term historical secular development, which will go on, hopefully. I remember one of the German veterans was an Air Force pilot who used to fly his Heinkel bombers to the east coast of England. He told me something I didn't know at the time, that the V1s, the buzz bombs as we used to call them, the doodle bugs, that used to be launched from sites in France and so on at England, at London in particular, that I didn't realize that some of them were launched from Heinkel bombers, and he was one of the pilots who did that. Can't have been a very nice job to launch buzz bomb from your bomber, that he used to fly to the English east coast in 44-45 and launch them at our cities. And I was particularly interested in that. I'm particularly interested in the German air offensive against England because I was born in 1942 in York, and as I told you earlier, at 9 weeks old I was a survivor of a famous and notorious raid, which we call them Baedeker raids from the German guidebook. Five English cathedral cities were attacked in the spring of 1942 in retaliation for our Air Force burning down the centre of Lübeck, a beautiful German city on the Baltic, and destroying their medieval buildings, Well, I was born in February 1942, and in April 1942, I was 9 weeks old in York, which was one of the five Baedeker towns which were chosen for retaliation for that raid on Lübeck. So I'm a survivor of that, but you don't interview me about that because I don't have any memories of that, of course.
But it just gives a clear illustration of the time, and in fact, what you could conclude from that is that we're all victims of the circumstances and the time and the political situation that we live in.
Well, I see many victims of war in all sorts of ways, and the victims, I see some... I only interview the lucky people, of course, because the unlucky people are the ones who didn't survive. But even the lucky ones who did survive bear the scars in all kinds of ways. I recently visited a place in Richmond, London, called the Star and Garter Homes, home for disabled servicemen and women, and saw the terrible injuries of some of the chaps in there who've been, some of them in there for 50 years with the most severe injuries, and having to live with those injuries. Marvelous facilities there that have been provided for them, medical staff, a whole hospital there, I think, but have been there for the will be there for the rest of their lives. And you can see I'm wearing a poppy today, and this is in a way of gratitude for people like that who gave so much sacrifice, and yeah, also in thankfulness to my own father who served in the Navy, my father-in-law who served in the Air Force in the Second World War, my grandfathers who served in the Army in the First World War. And it's a time we like to remember the sacrifices that have been made. But the sacrifices have been civilians as well. My mother was bringing me up in the war under difficult circumstances of shortages and so on. And the way in which family life was affected as well. But I know that I always found it difficult to get on with my own father. I have a brother and sister, they got on with him much, a younger brother and sister who got on with him much better than I did. And I often feel that perhaps the reason why I didn't get on with him so well is because he was absent in the Navy for 3 years, 3 or 4 years, whilst I was a baby. And I know that many English children, when their fathers came back from the war, would say to their mother, "Who is this man?" It must have been very wounding for men to come back and be rejected in that way by their own children. And war causes many scars, physical and mental. And one thing I've learned about working for a war museum is think many times before you get yourself into a war or conflict. I'm not a pacifist, but don't go into a war at the drop of a hat. Think very carefully.
Now, when you walk around in the impressive buildings of the Imperial War Museum, the name itself says it, the first thing that meets you before the entrance is two giant guns. You'd think that it was an expression of the glory of war, but when you walk around in the different rooms and the big high-ceiling halls, you realize that it's certainly not a glorification of war, it's quite the opposite.
Well, I've sometimes been told that by people I meet at parties and in social life. They say to me, "Well, of course your museum glorifies war." And my answer always is, "Well, I don't think it does. Obviously we show hardware like the 15-inch naval guns that are outside the museum, which are the first thing that you see from two battleships. Obviously, as you go around, you can see tanks and aeroplanes and guns and submarines and this type of thing. They're legitimately part and parcel of a war museum, so that you can see what these objects look like. And of course, it's an education itself. You often hear children say, when they see a Spitfire, "I didn't realize they were so small." And obviously it's very misleading if you only read books or even see films. from when you actually see the object itself, you can learn a lot. But I certainly don't think we glorify war. There's plenty of things in the museum which shows the horrific side of war. And certainly doing my job, I've learned a great deal. Thankfully, it's secondhand about war, which is horrific. And I would say that I would just ask one question of anybody who tended to make this accusation against our museum. Who is more likely to get into a war, a person who knows very little about it, or a person who knows a lot about it? And our museum, after all, is to spread knowledge of what war is really like.
And in conclusion, now that you're talking about war and peace, I noticed walking over here to the Sound Archives, which is another building from the big halls over on the other side. Now there's a Tibetan peace garden being built at the moment with some beautiful sculptures also. They are busy at work at the moment. This could be a symbol of the peace that we all seek and long for in this world.
Well, I'm all in favor of peace. I'm certainly not a war enthusiast, I can assure you. I never was when I first came to the museum, and I'm even less of one now after 20 years at it. There's very little of that element amongst the staff who work at the museum. Quite the contrary.
You could say that many people accuse people like us who interview resistance people and all other kinds of people who have memories of what it's like during a war, that we are mad about war and we glorify war. In all its manners, but I think it's quite the opposite, as you said yourself.
Well, I never dreamt that I would work for a war museum. I never dreamt that I'd work for any kind of museum whatsoever. I should say that after I left university, I went into school teaching. That was my job, so I'm very much a pedagogue, if you like. I like imparting information. That was always my profession, and it was only by sheer chance that I came to be involved with museum work. I went back to university after about 8 years teaching to take up Indian studies. So 20 years ago I was a specialist on Indian history, and India used to be the subject in which I was particularly interested in. All that's become rather rusty now because by sheer chance those Indian studies led me to the War Museum. And I never dreamt that war would become my main interest, which has usurped India as my interest now. But that's just one of the quirks of chance that your professional life pushes you into. But I don't regret it. I've got a great deal out of working as an interviewer for the museum. And I'm very thankful to the museum that they've got this admirable oral history program. They're one of the pioneers in oral history. That it started up as early as 1972, and that we get people from all over the world, like yourself, coming to show an interest in it.
Conrad Wood husker specielt to japanske krigsveteraner, der havde slået sig ned i London, og han interviewede dem der. Det var meget interessant, fordi den ene af dem havde netop kæmpet i Kohima i Burma i 1944, hvor Conrad Woods egen onkel kæmpede mod japanerne i Royal Scottish Regiment. Og hans onkel blev såret i halsen, fortalte han til de to japanere, hvor den ene så straks så lidt skræmt ud, for han var bange for, at det måske var brutalitet. Måske der var nogle japanere, der havde været brutale og begået krigsforbrydelser, men det var altså i kamp, det her, så det var ikke tilfældet. Den ene af de to japanske krigsveteraner havde været det, man kalder en supply sergeant, det vil sige, at han skulle stå for forsyningerne til tropperne. Han havde altså ikke været involveret i nogen som helst krigsforbrydelser. Conrad Wood nævnte lige, at han var lidt ked af, at han ikke kunne overtale sin egen onkel til at blive interviewet til Bondarkivet. Men jeg stillede jo også spørgsmålet med hensyn til, om der var nogle af de interviewede fra den tabende side, der havde følt skyld. Men det har han ikke sådan set oplevet med nogen af dem. Og heller ikke i det her tilfælde med de to japanere. For de havde kun kæmpet, som soldater nu engang kæmper i kamp. Nu fortalte den ene af disse soldater til båndet, at hver eneste japansk soldat havde ris i sit tornyster, og når den portion ris var brugt op, så havde han ikke mere at spise. Og det var så op til den her supply sergeant at finde mad til soldaterne. Det kunne være meget vanskeligt. Det lykkedes dem at erobre et lager, som egentlig var under britisk kommando, med masser af mad og ris, og det var nok til, at de kunne klare sig i 3 år, disse japanske soldater. Men ved slutningen af krigshandlingerne var maden sluppet op fra dette lager, og de japanske tropper, der var overlevende efter kampene med englænderne ved Kohima og blev taget til fange, var i en meget, meget ringe stand, altså med forfærdelige sygdomme på grund af sult. Men den her japanske soldat har fortalt det til båndet om, at han faktisk blev rigtig dårligt behandlet af de britiske styrker, da han blev taget som krigsfange, blandt andet ved, at man nægtede fangerne mad.